Warning: The Mended Futures podcast contains stories told by guests that may be sensitive to some people. Viewer and listener discretion is advised. The opinions expressed by guests do not reflect the views of the hosts and/or producers of this podcast.
Today, we had the pleasure of talking to Chantel Spinner, and I thought we were going to talk mainly about her role as a local doula. But we ended up talking about so much.
So much. You guys bonded on taking rest as a mother, a working mother, how to say no, how to advocate for your own mental health and your family's schedules. And yeah, it was just a very natural, important conversation to have.
It was amazing to hear what one everyday person is doing in this community. And I think that's a theme with a lot of our guests, is we think we're going to talk about one part of their role, but they are filling so many roles in our village.
Mm-hmm. We hope you enjoy.
Hey, Taylor.
Hey.
We've got a really special guest here this afternoon.
We sure do.
It's going to be great. It's going to be a topic that maybe our listeners aren't as familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. I like that kind of thing.
So do I.
So, who are you?
I'm Chantel Spinner, Lynchburg native, wife, mother, reproductive justice advocate. I'm in the junior league for my second year this year.
Cool.
Also a doula, lactation consultant. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying all these things just to boost myself up. And sometimes I forget.
Fair.
But people would say that I'm pretty funny, but I think I'm serious 97% of the time.
Hmm.
I like to be behind the scenes. So now in front of the camera and talking about everything is different for me, but I'm challenging myself. I'm happy about that.
Amazing. Well, thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So what is a doula?
So a doula is a non-medical professional. I kind of say I do informational things, like provide information to clients, emotional support, and like physical support as in touch or massage. Really, it's an advocacy, I feel like, all the way around. I'm there in the room when they're giving, you know, labor. I kind of am the bridge between the medical professionals and the birthing people and their families. And I like to say that because if I'm there and something's going on and they don't understand, I help break that down. I usually try to set the tone. So when we go in, I tell everybody, this is our space. Whatever you want it to be, this is what it's going to be. I'm really a person that's invested, but not as heavily invested as the people who child is going to be or parents. So I'm kind of a neutral party, and I've mediated in quite a few births. And I feel like it's hard to say tasks because everyone needs different things. But non-medical, I can't help you, you know, if your baby's coming, I'm calling someone else, whether it's at home or, you know, at the hospital. But I'm just there to fill in the gap for people who think it's a, you know, a good service.
So do you support women through pregnancy and postpartum?
Yes.
So is a doula more than somebody that's there during the birth?
Yes. So usually I try to get people to call me as early as they can. I've had people say, hey, you know, the test just turned positive. Let's talk about this. And I've had people that called me at 36 weeks and they're looking for someone. But the best thing I feel like, or the best way to get the most out of having a doula, is to call like first trimester. We meet, talk about what you want, talk about who we are, if we'll mesh good together. And then from there, I'll start providing them with educational materials. I'll meet them about once a month in their home for an hour. I always tell people, you don't have to entertain me. If you're wearing pajamas, if you're doing whatever, we're just going to hang out.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we're actually at the place where you're in labor, we're not going to worry about all that. So after they have the baby, I'm there for probably the next couple hours if they're at the hospital until they go to mother baby. If they give birth at home, it's until usually before the midwives and them leave. And then I come visit them at home with the baby. I can help with breastfeeding. I'm also a lactation consultant. So some people call and say, hey, our next visit, this is what we want to work on. They have full access to me via phone. We can FaceTime or, you know, Zoom, whatever, from the time they sign their contract and on up. So if your baby's 1 year old, I'm like, please still call me. That way I can give you insight. I would prefer for people to call and not Google and scare themselves half to death, which I'm sure all parents have done.
Yeah. WebMD says.
Yes.
It's so yes. tempting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I get a lot of pictures like, do you think this belly button looks fine? Or have you ever seen a baby pull their hair? And I'm like, of course.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. It's really just trying to be who I needed when I had my babies. Mm. Just that person to be around. I can get along with pretty much anybody. And I don't really take things personally. So it's everything. So I say pregnancy, birth, postpartum, and beyond.
Mm-hmm. And you're a mom.
I am a mom. Mm-hmm. Two girls. I always wanted three. A second mm-hmm. one came, and then we just, you know, that was enough. She's mm-hmm. two and one.
Amazing.
But when I had my first daughter, I wasn't here in Lynchburg. I was living in Fredericksburg, and I didn't know anything about birth. I think about it now, like, I didn't know how it worked. Like, nobody explained to me that, you know, you just don't get to 10 centimeters and baby just comes out. Mm-hmm. So I had a difficult experience. I was kind of, you know, forced into an induction, and then that ended up in a C-section. And I had a lot of anxiety from that. Mm-hmm. I parented from a anxious place. And then my daughter does have anxiety now mm-hmm. because I parented from that. So once I kind of got into this realm, I give people just try to start them on a good foundation. That way you have things set in place. Everybody thinks, well, not everybody. A lot of people think if we have all the room set up, the nursery, baby shower, you're ready. I always tell people if you are emotionally supported, have a good team and kind of know what you're walking into and how to advocate for yourself, then you're ready to take on, you know, birth and parenthood.
I might need to unpack the parenting from the anxious standpoint. That is, I think that's a lot of us.
Yes.
And that's powerful to show women that you could have a peaceful, not ratcheted up experience. So that's absolutely different from a lot of people's experiences.
I definitely would say that. When I'm in the room, I always tell people, whatever you want, as long as it's not an emergency, we'll do that. Like if mm-hmm. someone comes in and they're rude to you, we'll ask that person kindly. We don't want to have that person come here anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Or we'll take a break and say, hey, maybe a lot's going on. We just want to talk about this. Come back.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of rights that you have as the patient, as the person who is paying for these services, or your insurance is paying for these services. And I feel like in the medical world, it's usually not seen that way. Usually if you're a customer somewhere, they're like, oh, we want to please the customer. But in a lot of medical places, or, you know, they think you listen to this person. And I tell people to tell their providers, thank you for that information. But for me and my family, I'm going to think about it, or I'd like to go a different way. Because a lot of people call me after appointments and they're like, I didn't feel like I had a voice. Mm. I didn't feel like I could say something to them. And I just try to, you know, go over things. We even write it out like, next time, mm-hmm. this is what you can say to feel like you, you know, have a hold on what's going on. Because birth is 80% mental. Hmm. 80%. And I'm thinking, okay, as long as your mind's in there and you've got your mind together, people say, oh, well, how does someone go about a natural birth? They're mentally prepared. Mm-hmm. They feel secure. They feel like, I think that I'm going to make it out of here. You know, things can happen, but just to be able to be in a place to where you know that people are watching out for you, it means a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you get from someone who didn't know anything about birth, who is giving birth and is now raising a child from an anxious place because you didn't know about what the birthing experience would be, to a professional and an advocate for women who were in your position?
I feel like it fell into my lap a little bit. Like, I've always been around people who've had birth. I was probably a doula before I was certified. I had a cousin who, I was on the phone with her, been there when people gave birth. However, when I attended Randolph College during COVID, I went to college as an adult. I was, you know, there. It was very hard. And I already had my kids, 5 classes. Like, I'm doing this. But I met, they have a scholar that comes every few years. Her name's Justina Licata. Justina, if you hear this, I love you. She studies and she taught us about reproductive justice. Cool. First time I ever heard the term. And I was like, all right, I'm going to sign up. I'm going to do all these things. And I feel like I was home when I was learning about those topics. I was like, yeah, you know, the right to, you know, have a baby, the right to not have a baby, the right to, you know, raise your child in a safe environment, you know, bodily autonomy. I'm like, I'm all for, you know, women having all of these things and what it could mean. So as we dug deeper into that, our goal was to have a symposium, and the students, we put that together. So we had to have different panels and topics, and my panel was Black maternal health. So I looked around and I asked people to come speak on the panel. It was COVID, so it was virtual. And we were reading Killing the Black Body. And actually, Dorothy, and I can't think of her name right now. I could be. But the author of Killing the Black Body, she spoke. She was our keynote speaker. But my panel was Black maternal health. I had some doulas come. I had some people that also kind of work with the prison and pregnant people there. They came and they talked and they were like, well, this is what a doula does. And I was like, a doula? How do you become one? Like, I literally typed it out. I was like, how do you become a doula? And then it was a girl that I actually graduated from high school with. She was a doula. And I was like, oh, right. You know, what did you do? She told me. And from that point, I signed up for the next class to become a doula. And I didn't know. I was like, oh, you just got to do something. No, you had to read 5 books. You had to do this whole packet. And our symposium was in March. So by May, my sister graduated from Randolph that May. And I didn't make it to her graduation because I was graduating from my and getting my doula certification. So it happened very fast. Quickly. I felt like it was all that I was thinking about. I was like, this can really be impactful. I didn't know what I wanted to do after school. After that, I just feel like I got certification after certification because I was thinking, okay, now I'm a doula, but what about the lactation piece? You know, I struggled breastfeeding my first child. Statistically, they think that, you know, women of color don't breastfeed. A lot of people have had problems. So then I went into, you know, 90-hour lactation course, and it just kind of stemmed from there. And I didn't think anybody was going to hire me. I made a website. I was like, I'm going to do this all by myself. I didn't ever think like I'm going to, I didn't know it was like local doula things you could work for. They had mentioned it in my class, but so I made my own website. I got the name, went through the SEC, got all of those things, got an LLC, did all these things. And then my cousin was pregnant, and that was the first birth that I attended.
Wow. And do you feel like it's your calling?
I do. I really do. And it makes me happy. I work a full-time job, but it's a breath of fresh air when I get to be in those rooms. When I usually do a lot of evening appointments, it always makes me happy just to be able to serve and give back in those ways. I would do it for free if I, you know, if it wasn't so long, but I do, you know, every year I have, I give a free birth to somebody who can't afford to pay because of course, you know, with insurance and all of those things. But I always tell people, slide and scale. We'll work it out. You just give me a little bit, every paycheck if you want to do that. So I just want to be that person in our community that you can come to. I always tell people, I give you a free consultation. If you don't like my personality, I'll help you find someone who can support you. Because you need to have someone who you can see yourself talking to, being open and honest with, actually being in your labor room and not you getting upset and frustrated with them easily. And I know sometimes people are like, you probably will talk yourself out of a job. I haven't yet, but I always give the option.
You want them to know that.
That I will refer you to many other doulas in the city, give you a list. if, you know, I don't work out for you.
So you have a quote on your website, and it says, women with lots of melanin are dying in great numbers for birth-related reasons. It's 2024. And I think that a lot of people who have had babies can remember the feeling of, and you've even mentioned it so far in the podcast, of, am I going to live through this? My great-grandmother didn't live through it. You know, my first birth was horrific, and I wasn't sure I was going to live through it. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, that quote and how you came to focus on it, how that's playing out here locally. I would bet that people don't know a lot about maternal health unless it's happened to someone that they know.
I agree with that. A lot of people don't know. And while at Randolph, while studying reproductive justice and thinking about what I was going to do my senior thesis and all of those things on, I did a qualitative study with about 10, 11 women of color from all over. And I was looking, like, what common experiences, like, have, is it just, my first thing, it was like, I can link slavery to current maternal problems. I feel like, to me, it made perfect sense. And recently, I feel like in the news, a lot of celebrities have been coming forward, like Serena Williams, mm-hmm. talking about how she wasn't listened to. And I'm thinking, most people know who Serena Williams is. Like, she has money, she has power, she has access to great health care. But even when she gave birth to her daughter, she had to fight with them to say, hey, I feel like I have a blood clot. She's had them before, and they didn't listen to her. And she fought and fought and fought, and finally she was able to get some assistance. And she didn't have even greater complications. Mm-hmm. Even people, you know, Beyonce and other, you know, Black celebrity women have spoke about things that are happening when they're, you know, with medical professionals. So just maternal health in the United States is bad overall. Mm. For us being a developed country, we have really bad health care, especially for birthing women. Mm. Subsequently to that, the racial inception of the United States leads to women of color dying at, you know, alarming rates, mm-hmm. versus some third world countries, they don't even have the rates that we have.
Really?
And you would think, you know, we're a developed nation, we have all of this money, like, this is the place we want to be. But because of the system. So really, it's the medicalization of childbirth. A lot of people don't know that kind of back in even, you know, I guess, I don't know, I'm not a history person, mm-hmm. so I won't say, but like back when the country first came to be, everybody gave birth at home.
Yeah.
There was a midwife, there was a granny midwife, there was a person. It was a community birthing experience. Mm-hmm. We're trying to get back to that now, but J. Marion Sims and some other people that, you know, they created the fields of obstetrics and gynecology. They experimented on women of color to kind of find these things. Yeah. And then childbirth was something that money could be made off of. They opened hospitals and they allowed people to come in, as well, white women anyway, to birth there. Mm-hmm. And they kind of ousted the Black granny midwives and people, like, why would you want this unclean person to help you give birth? So since that's happened, and the community birthing experience has been medicalized, birth has went downhill. You can see that in all the research that I did. And now I feel like it's a sterile situation when you go to the hospital, and it's not just what this one person needs. It's overall, this is what's best for.
Yeah, it's more of a procedure than a community support.
Yes. Hmm. So they come, when you go to a hospital now, even for birth, it's kind of like they're solving a problem. Birth is not a problem. I come in, your body's going to do what it's going to do. Problems may arise that we would have to deal with, but necessarily there's not a problem when we go there. So when someone's labor is stalled, they're like, this is a problem. Versus we're like, let's see if we can do other things to get it jump started. Mm-hmm. So really with that whole hospital aspect, and I'm not against hospital births, but it's just how things are now with, all the rules and regulations for obstetrics, it kind of changed how things were. And even that I didn't know the term, and nobody that I knew the term of having a doula or the community birthing experience. I think as we get back to that, it really has made the difference for, women that I know locally here and everywhere. I feel like Lynchburg is a little bit slower on the trend of doula being a term that's heard, but it has grown, I feel like, in the last 3 years that I've been doing this.
I would definitely say that there's more of a, and I love to hear the history of it because I am a history person, going back to the community part of birthing, and that it's not a medicalized problem. I'm pretty sure I've heard my mom talk about some things in history, and I'm pretty sure she and her siblings were born like when the mother was in twilight sleep. Mm-hmm. So they would actually give the mom anesthesia and the mom would have no recollection.
You woke up and you had the baby.
I have never heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
So they forced that baby out of the mother.
I'm pretty sure my mom and all of her siblings were born that way.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's so interesting to hear the history of childbirth. Switching topics, talk to us a little bit about your junior league experience and, why that's important to you.
So once again, I never had heard of junior league, and people said, oh, well, actually, one of my clients, she was like, I'm in the junior league. That's where I volunteer. I've met people. I feel like it's hard to meet adult friends, and mm-hmm. it's hard to feel like, for me, I hadn't felt like I belonged in a space here in Lynchburg. I moved back when my daughter was 2. She's now 11. I feel like I've been fighting for somewhere to just, I don't want to be accepted. I just want to feel like I feel good there. So last year, I was like, okay, it was the first Black president for here, Junior League, Michelin Hall. I was like, all right, I'm going to give it a shot. I want to volunteer, but I don't have the time to figure out where to go to volunteer. It's all, in one place.
You mean working a full-time job, doula-ing, Mama. Raising children? You don't have a lot of free time?
I don't.
Imagine that.
Yeah. Yeah. But I feel like my job is to serve. Like, I love to serve the community, just be behind the scenes. One of the reasons that after I graduated from Randolph that I stayed here was like, can I make a difference in this community? Mm-hmm. So I set out to say, if I'm staying here, how can I make this community better? How can I leave an impact? Mm-hmm. Whatever. So I joined the junior league, and I was like, okay, we'll just see how it is. But I really met some of the, best women. I really felt supported. We had a diverse group of women that were there, and now I could, call on probably 4 or 5 of them and say, hey, I need you. I need somebody to talk to. Mm-hmm. And things, the support was something I'd never experienced before for people outside of my family. Mm-hmm. But also, I think historically, Junior League has not been for, women of color. And they're changing those things. They got a DEIB. And I've had a really good experience in thinking about how can we make Junior League better. I feel like the millennial in me is like, coming through, like, we're getting a little older now.
Yeah.
We're, gonna be in charge coming up. Mm-hmm. And it feels like the changes that are being made in Junior League is something I definitely would support. And I was telling everybody, come on and join. I'm helping out with the new members this year and just trying to encourage them to make the most of it. Mm-hmm. But I definitely would want my daughters to experience something like that. Just working with people that we don't necessarily always agree on things, but it's respectful. Mm-hmm. Because I really need that when you're around people that just say yes, 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 or this is what I like. You don't get to hear like why things happen. And I'm a big person of why do you think that? Or what led you to believe this? Mm. And I feel that being in Junior League, I've had conversations that when I left, I was like, this is great because I can understand people more on a, you know, a micro level than just saying a group of people or things like that. So that's what Junior League is doing for me. And we had a new member project and we collected bags for the local group home. We did that. And then, you know, talked at the YMCA. Like, those are things that I like to do. And I'm very happy to be there. And I think as the years come and different people are in the seat of president and things, I think it'll just become kind of a lot more diverse than it has been.
Life is messy, and sometimes people just need someone safe to talk to. We're here to listen because everyone's story should be heard. 518 Counseling exists to empower children, adults, and families to overcome past experiences and create a path to being stronger both mentally and spiritually. Family is a nuanced concept. 518's family care team brings simple solutions to complex situations through professional intervention, interpersonal support, and parenting education. We strive for an outcome of mending families and keeping children safe. 518's Connect team equips and empowers volunteers with the training and support to serve confidently by matching their passions with opportunities. Our outreach is targeted to build partnerships with individuals, churches, agencies, and businesses. At Hat Creek Camp, we provide exceptional camp experiences with careful attention to the needs of youth, encouraging campers to grow through trust-based challenges and successes. It's a place to build relationships, inspire change, and transform lives.
I know you said that you didn't know what you were going to do after you graduated, but what were you in school for?
Sociology.
Okay.
I love, love, love sociology. I love to, like, figure out like what is going on. I think it validated a lot of my feelings too. Like, I know some people say, well, you just pull yourself up by your bootstraps and we're gonna make it. I'm like, ah, wait a minute, that's kind of not the same for everyone. And there are laws and things put in place in our country that systematically keep certain people in certain places. So I had a goal of like kind of working for social services, doing something before I graduated. That's what I did. I worked in foster care. I got the job there, worked in it. Tough job. Shout out to all the people, you know, working in the foster care realm, because it was a lot more emotionally taxing than I thought. Because previous to me going to school, I was a stay at home mom for 8 years. So I just kind of did all those things, jumped right back out into the workforce. And I feel like I didn't think that I can make much of a difference there for what I wanted to do. I think it's a difference that can be made, but I like to be able to spend time with people and have a different, like, personalized experience. And it's just a lot that needs to be done. So I didn't know what I wanted to do. And at times I thought that I would be a doula full time. However, it can cause burnout. I did it for a long, long time because you're on call pretty much from 34 to 36 weeks. You're on call till that baby comes. I don't leave the city. I want to be at every birth. I don't want to chance it. I don't have a backup person. Some agencies, you have another person say, hey, I'm going to be out next weekend. Can you take over for my client? I've never had that. So even when I wasn't feeling well, like, I just pop some cold medicine and go on in to a birth. But doing that for kind of a year straight, I was so exhausted. And I don't think that I gave the best of myself because I was tired and I was agitated. I really believe that I have a specialty and I just want to put all of kind of my energy into this thing, but give the best of me instead of like spreading myself thin. Mm-hmm. So now that I do it just on my own terms and I don't depend on it as a sole source of income, it allows me to do a better job, mm-hmm. I think.
Did that, when you were burnout, did that impact your relationship with your kids and it your did. Family as well?
It did. Because I couldn't really plan anything. It was my daughter's birthday. I'm like, we're not going to plan a birthday party. Mm. I'm the one that's going to host the party. What are we going to do if I'm not here? Mm. Or no, we can't kind of go to Richmond for the weekend or something because I'm on call.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time it's just waiting. Like, and it's nighttime. Mm-hmm. My kids are 8 and 11 now. But, you know, 3 years ago they weren't. And they're kind of like, you're going to leave tonight. We're going to sleep somewhere else. The dad works third shift. It was difficult. My family.
I live that life.
Yeah.
Yes.
My family would take, you know, I could drop them off, but it was difficult. And I ran into that this year where I was at the hospital. I think it was 32 hours in. And then it was Monday. And then Tuesday was the first day of school. And my kids kept calling. They were like, are you going to be able to make it to the first day of school? And I'd say, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. They're not used to me not showing up mm-hmm. for them. They yeah. understand. They probably know a lot more about birth mm-hmm. than maybe some other kids in their class. But they're not used to me not being there. Even though they had other people that were there. But I did make it. Baby was born at 2 a.m. I went home, slept a few hours. I got up at 6
mm-hmm.
and I saw them off to their first day of school. But it's very hard to decide how much do I want to take from my kids to pour into someone else. So I try to really balance that, especially while they're really young. And I feel like they need me more than ever now.
Let's talk about that, because that is a huge topic for me personally. And also, you know, when we talk to folks on podcast episodes, there's a cost to everything. I have a wise friend who says there, you know, there's a cost to everything. And when you're a community advocate or you're a helper, or, you know, when you think of all the nonprofits and all of the civic organizations and all of the faith communities here, oftentimes we're pouring into other people's families. How have you over the years found more of that balance?
Stop saying yes to everything. And I have a hard time saying no.
You two are kindred
spirits. I have a hard time. I'm talking to my counselor, you know, every 2 weeks. And I'm like, I did not say no, but I really wanted to. So just like, I feel like I need to say no and move on. I can't give you
a spiel, or
I can't. You just don't say anything else. No, period. But
no,
I don't.
No is a complete sentence.
Yes, no is a complete sentence. And me being an overthinker, and I talk too much, I want to say no because of now I'm just like, you cannot do it if you're exhausted. I don't show up as my best person when I'm very tired. And I had to work a full-time job and feel secondhand trauma. And my kids say to me, you're mean when you come home. I don't like you having a job now. I was burnt out from like coming home and then decompressing on a 15-minute ride. And then you come home and my kids, they want me to show up when I come through that door.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care. They're like, such and such did this. I've got this paper for you to sign. I've got all of these things. And I ended up taking a pay cut to take a job that I felt like cared about their employees more. But now I have my time budgeted to where I budget my time where my kids are in there, like mm-hmm. even if it says read in the evening yeah. or all of those things, because I feel like I can do it all. I'm doing a lot of things and I still feel like I'm falling short. I talk about that a lot, how I'm so happy when I'm with babies and with other people, and sometimes I go home and I'm like, if just tonight I didn't have to cook dinner, or just, you know. So those are the things that I do. Try to make a meal plan. Make sure I cook. Let my kids help me cook, because I've cooked all the time. But sometimes, like, just not tonight. I don't want you to chop these things up, or I don't want you to help stir that pot. So just to think, like, I need to make sure we're straight at home. And then after that, give to everyone else, but it's definitely hard.
How did you learn to balance that, Allison?
I feel like what you just described is the season that I am currently in or have been in for the last 3 or 4 years. I tell people that the season I'm in right now, I like to think about seasons.
Yes.
The season of life that I'm in right now, I'm calling it my season of no. If you ask me to do anything after dark, I'm going to say no. I will be at home with my family. I think we have very similar things going on as far as husbands who work different shifts, and I have 2 children, and they weren't getting the best of me, and other people in the community were getting the best of me. My parents are aging, and I want to be my best self for people that I care the most about, and I feel like the important people were getting leftovers, and I just started to say no. And I waited for the backlash. I was waiting when I told people no to things that I would have said yes to in a heartbeat recently. Mm-hmm. And I said no. And another blessing would come along right after it, or something that made even more sense would happen right after it. And there's a reason that I'm supposed to be saying no to some opportunities. Or I went to a women's conference like a week and a half ago, and they talked about saying no actually lets another person get a leadership opportunity. So me saying yes to everything could have been blocking someone else's blessings, but it is hard. I've started saying, no, I have other plans.
Yes.
I'm not even quite sure what my other plans are sometimes. Like, I plan to go home and lay on my couch. That's sometimes my plan.
That's a plan.
That's what I say. I plan to just be in peace and to gather myself for the weekend, because Monday I've got to hit the ground running. Mm-hmm. So I definitely agree. Mm-hmm. I mean, saying no, and also I can say it, but then feeling okay with my decision, or not beating myself up when it's like, I could have done this. I could have, like, I can't do everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to pick and choose. Mm-hmm. So, but I think it'll always be a struggle. But I'm coming to see that even when I didn't do it, it still got done.
Mm-hmm.
It's, yeah, part of it is also coming to the reality that the world doesn't revolve around us. And life will go on if we say no. Yeah,
but your household does.
Yeah.
That's, you know, true. When you think about it. But the community doesn't. Right. Or I don't know.
There
I think
are other people to fill the slots.
Yes, and they will. We have to have faith that other people will. I love hearing you talk about, I would say, doula-ing, being a doula is your passion project. Yes. I love hearing you talk about burnout and acknowledging that sometimes too much of a good thing is too much. And for people in our audience listening who want to know how they can help their community, sometimes you don't do your passionate helping thing full time. Sometimes it is your part time, or it is a once in a while, because it can be something that leads to burnout. What do you do as a full time? You said you worked in foster care. So what do you do? What do you do as a full time job?
I'm a case manager for a brain injury nonprofit.
That doesn't
some light work.
Yeah. Right. I was like, wow, right. That sounds really not stressful at all.
It's I work for a great company, Brain Injury Solutions, and I serve Lynchburg, Campbell, and Bedford County. It's different from kind of working when I was for social services, because I get to go in these people's homes and spend the time and make my own schedule and give them what they're needed. So it gives me that one-on-one time with people. I can see the difference that I'm making.
Meaningful relationships.
Yes, meaningful relationships. They know that if they call me, we're not emergency. I had a tough time coming from an emergency place. Like, call 911. Yes. Don't call me. But I can give them the attention that they need and deserve. It's a vulnerable population that I didn't know much about before I came into the job. But I really love I feel like be there with the underdogs and just help and provide resources. Because really, I think as a case manager, I'm just the middleman. I'm just getting them to where they need, or, you know, do you need housing? Do you need to find another PCP? Let me do those things. Mm-hmm. And I also get to do a lot of networking things in the community where I just say, hey, we're here. If you know somebody that needs us, we can help them out, or, you know, running an in-person support group just to know you're not alone, and just to have somebody that they can call on, I think is the biggest thing. Because some people, I'm like, what do I even do for them when I go to their house? But I heard someone say, like, just them knowing that someone cares, mm-hmm. and that every month they're going to see you, or you're going to call and check on them, is enough. So I really like doing that.
So in both of your roles, your full-time role and your passion role, you're working with clients, but you're also working with caregivers.
Yes.
You're a good mediator.
I am. Now, if I could use that at home, I would probably be better. But I am a good mediator. I feel like I can stay calm a lot of the times. I don't panic. Teenage
me. Teach me your way.
Teenage me. I wish I was, but I don't really panic. And I'm good with thinking on my feet and just being able to manage a lot of things going on. It's probably a trauma response if you ask my counselor, but I'm able to be that person and say, hey, let's just take a look at it, or let's just try a different way. Or they're like, no one cares about me. I'm thinking, you don't forget about me that I'm here. But yeah. Learning empathy. I learned that last mm-hmm. year. I didn't know that I wasn't very empathetic. I definitely didn't know that. My family didn't practice it, so I'm still learning. Or have you ever heard someone say, well, I had a bad day, and then, like, I had a bad day too. Like, mm-hmm. you're not supposed to say that, I mm-hmm. guess. You're supposed to say, I couldn't imagine the day that you've had. I couldn't imagine going through something like that. So that's definitely helping me to be more patient. But it really pushes me to be patient with brain injury survivors, because they don't remember things and they are mm-hmm. forgetful. They aren't children, but I use a lot of the things that I, you know, the patients that I bring for home with them. But it's not as taxing. I don't get as much kind of secondhand trauma with that.
As with the doula stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as with the doula and as with when I worked for foster care.
Got it. And I would say secondhand trauma or secondary trauma mm-hmm. is a fairly new term.
Definitely.
And, yeah. you know, as a former educator, we had just started talking about that in the late 2010s. Mm-hmm. You know, pre-COVID, we were talking about, wow, even though the educator may not be experiencing the trauma, but working with children who come from trauma, and the more trauma-informed we are, you know, it's important for people when you think about where is your place on the river. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about the Vision 30 river, there's a healthy river, an unhealthy river. In a lot of ways, you're talking about standing in the river. Some people should not work in situations where they're going to experience a lot of secondary trauma.
Definitely.
And folks who do, when you think of medical professionals, mm-hmm. Social services, police officers, fire, rescue, you know, when you're constantly experiencing these things, other people along the river in the village need to pray for, support.
Definitely.
I mean,
pour into.
And a lot of those people need mental health services mm-hmm. themselves. So I think as we become more trauma informed, there's an intricate web along the river of how we support each other and how we support our clients.
Definitely. Because it's a fine line between, oh, I really love doing this, but it leaves me depleted.
Mm-hmm. Or you can't sleep.
Yeah. And I cannot manage after this, or mm-hmm. it just sets something off in me that will throw me off all day long. Mm-hmm. And I think just realizing that and knowing that I can support in other ways, maybe I'll be a fundraiser, maybe I'll be someone that just spreads the news, mm-hmm. but the one-on-one or the daily, that's not for me.
Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. I think we need to realize as we think about how we can be the village, how we can make a difference as everyday people, that sometimes the work is not for them. I was over here kind of laughing, but that's my trauma response. Yeah. My anxiety has anxiety. You do not want me in a crisis situation. I freak out. I'm scared. I'm terrified. I am flight. I tell people I think I've used all my adrenaline up in my first 42 years because I immediately want to flee the situation. I should not be working in emergencies. And thank goodness there are enough things in the community where I don't need to be working in the emergencies.
Because I think the quickest response to hearing someone be like, I can't, you don't want me in the river, you don't want me on the front line is
like, it's hard.
Yeah, it's like that person is just avoiding it. That mm-hmm. person is unwilling. But it's like, no, that would be unhelpful for me yes. to be there.
I really, when I started like prioritizing my mental health, I really dug deep into what can I do? Mm-hmm. I want to be helpful, but what's the best thing for me? And then what's the best thing for everyone else?
How can I stay healthy enough for my family
yes.
while still making a positive impact on my community?
Because your Definitely. Healthiest self is your most impactful self.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I have a little bit more of that balance now. And I mean, I have so many planners and calendars and reminders like, okay, this is what you need to do. But I also have given myself permission to rest.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I didn't, even when I stayed home, I was doing so many other things that wasn't like a paid job. But now I'm like, I'm not going to do it. Or my kids can't go to every trunk or treat.
Mm-hmm.
We're just going to do these ones. And then I'm going to rest because I can show up better for them when if I'm I rested. Do. And let them see me to say, hey, we're not going to do anything this weekend. We're just going to be here and be okay with that. So definitely it's a work in progress, but getting a little better.
So the title of this podcast is called Mended Futures. Are you the product of a mended future?
So explain that a little bit to me and tell me what would be your definition of a mended future?
Did things happen in your childhood or generationally that now won't happen to your children, or you have healed from? Absolutely. And if it's not something you want to share, that's fine.
No.
But I think that a lot of people who choose to be the servants mm-hmm. are, and you said, I'm a doula because it's what I needed mm-hmm. when I was giving birth or when I was pregnant. You know, are there things that you've mended from your experiences?
Definitely. One of the reasons that I stayed home with my kids is because I was raised by a single mom and she worked a lot. She, you know, had to be a provider. And I wanted to be, I remember my classroom mom from elementary school. I remember that person going and doing those things. So I said that if I had the time or if I could manage it, this is who I wanted to be for my children when they were young. I wanted my child to not have to parent as much. I feel like in the 90s we were parentified. I don't think it's a bad thing, it's just what it was. Like, you know, latchkey kids, you had a key, you went home, me and my sister were there. Now I wouldn't dare leave my 11-year-old for maybe more than 10 or 15 minutes, but she gets to be a kid. She gets to have just a little bit of responsibility, and she still is pushing back on me for that. But she doesn't have expectations that are outside of a role that are for a child.
Yeah.
Also, I feel like just in growing up as a woman of color and their girls of color, just to have more confidence, to see themselves in the community or just be in a space financially where I can take them to travel or I can do things with them that I didn't experience. Like the first time, like the second flight that I took was with my kids. Like I flew as an adult and then they flew as a child just to have, to make it be purposeful that they'll have something to come back to, when they are older or when I'm not here. So I feel like all the things that I'm doing now is just to make sure that the way that I lived and, the poverty that I experienced, my kids don't have to, do that. And I think that because we were, you know, tight on money, we kind of didn't, we couldn't prioritize mental health and other things, kind of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Absolutely. Like if we needed all of these things, we couldn't even get to the level of I'm worried about how this impacts you. Like we need a place to stay. We need these things. You have to go to school, et cetera. So being comfortable financially and just being able to take the next step, I feel like my kids can take that and then also be able to have the next step from there for, you know, their kids if they choose to have them.
That's amazing. And I think one thing that is so comforting and hopeful, hope is really important, that you've done that in a generation, that you're able to recognize that some of the things that you were experiencing were out of your control because of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You try to survive mm-hmm. first, and you can't really think about what is the impact of leaving my children at home and being latchkey kids, or what's the impact of working multiple jobs on my kids. You can't think about those things when you're in the cycle, but definitely. I hope it's powerful for you to reflect and to tell how much you've overcome and how much has changed in a generation.
I'm working on that. I think that's one of the biggest things and one of the reasons that I wish that I was in counseling or saw someone for mental health a long time ago, because I was asked the question, like, when is enough? Like, I'm climbing. Mm-hmm. I'm getting there. Are you there? Like, how will you know when you're there? Like, I feel like I am on the path, but I haven't had the chance to sit back and look at the things that I've accomplished. So in this season, with me slowing down and saying, no, I want to just bask in, okay, look, I'm okay right now. There's some things that I want, but really the needs are met. So I'm working on that. And I think I had a big conversation with a lot of people that I knew is when you're moving from surviving to living, like I'm living now, but when I was in survival mode, I couldn't do that. Like we just had to worry about next day, this and that. And it takes a really long time. Well, not a long time. It takes strategic moves to change pace. Mm-hmm. To say, hey, you know, I know when I walk outside, my car's going to start up. I don't have to worry about, you know, I feel like that raggedy car stage is a, yeah. is a bad place to be when you don't, you know, you're anxious mm-hmm. about that. Mm-hmm. And poverty, anxiety, all those things went hand in hand for
me. You're holding your breath so much yeah. of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're like, what's going to happen? I don't have control. So then I was a control freak. Everything that I could have control of, I wanted to hold on really tight. So
as a trauma response.
Yes, as a trauma response. Mm-hmm. Like nobody can do it. I'm going to do it because mm-hmm. if I know I do it, it's going to get done.
Yep.
So just easing up on that and reminding myself all the time that you're actually making change. Like you can see that. Like, yeah, that's what I'm working on.
Because you have such a servant's heart, which Taylor talked about a little while ago, that you really do serve. What do you say to the person who's listening who wants to volunteer or wants to get involved, but they don't quite know how to take that next step or how to, you know, I think women especially are really social beings mm-hmm. and it's, you have to be brave to do some of this stuff. What would you say to someone who wants to make a difference, but doesn't quite know how?
I think you have to put yourself out there. And that's one of the main things that I was lacking. Like I would go places, but I wouldn't introduce myself or I wouldn't try to be with the people because it's scary, especially not to see people that look like you or just not to see people you think that are like you when you go somewhere to volunteer. I've been to places and I never did anything because I just, you know, didn't initiate it. So pick something. We've got a lot of things that people need help with. If it's something that you like, it's probably even better. And go there and just make a goal of, if I just talk to one person about one thing this time, if I just, you know, figure out something that I can do that's maybe not social or, you know, write letters or whatever it is, find something in somewhere you can start. Mm-hmm. Just starting it, just, you know, getting over your anxiety or whatever is holding you back can be one of the first steps to actually getting out there and making meaningful relationships, even with, you know, people in the community and businesses. So just do it.
I love it.
Perfect ending.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank
You're
you.
You're so welcome.
Thank you for listening to the Mended Futures podcast, hosted by Allison Jordan and Taylor Melvin, produced by Liam Chafin, Sue England, Allison Jordan, Robert Day, Sully Jugar, and Taylor Melvin. You can find us on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to like, share, and subscribe to see more.